This is The End User, episode 200 for Thursday, September 10th. A cacophony of sibilance. Hello, and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. Although, Chris, I don't even know if I am the Futurist Prime anymore. It's I didn't realize how much time had gone by.
That's right. So today is kind of a special podcast because we have an Apple event.
Oh man, it's like Christmas for me. And this year it was a good Christmas.
Actually, yeah, it was, and we'll get into that shortly. But it's also a special day because this is our 200th episode of The End User, which I think is quite a milestone, Taylor.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I wanted to take a second and look back to The End User episode 1, which you actually weren't on, and that was on February 4th, 2010, apparently, according to the post I'm looking at. We were talking about the first release of the iPad and something about the Nexus One and a couple other things.
Whoa, the Nexus One.
Yeah, I forgot about that one, didn't you?
I remember it. That brings me back. But wow, that's funny. So here we are talking about more iPads in a minute.
Yeah, it's true. And then I also, just for nostalgia's sake, went back and looked at episode 3, which was the first one that you were on, and we were talking about the first release of Windows Phone 7 series.
Oh, right.
So all kinds of fun stuff in our first few episodes. Also, if I don't say so myself, the production quality at the time was awful. We've definitely improved that substantially up to now.
Thanks to your tireless efforts.
Yes, yes. So anyway, I've got a bottle of champagne here, so I wanted to pop this, Taylor. Do you have your glass ready?
Yeah, but I don't think you should pour it through the microphone.
Yeah, I don't think that'll work, but we can figure out a way to get it to you. Now, I guess it's not champagne, it's Prosecco, right? It's not French champagne.
Right. We're that kind of classy.
Yes, exactly. So cheers. So, Taylor, here's to episode 200, and hopefully we'll have a handful more. And here's to the Apple event, too. Cheers.
Cheers.
How's that champagne?
Tastes suspiciously like a New Holland Fat Tire.
Yeah, so I don't want to spend too long, looking back over the years. We're not doing anything terribly impressive for our 200th episode, but it is definitely an exciting milestone for us, and I feel like we've been doing this for just about as long as anything that I've stuck to in my life. So it's been a good ride so far.
It's been a very good ride.
All right, well, should we get into our top news of the week as we sip our Prosecco, sir?
Yes, let's.
All right. Obviously,
need a refill.
Yeah. Here, I'll get you some real quick.
Thank you.
So, obviously, the top news of the week is something that happened just earlier today, and that was the boatload of news coming from Apple out of their event today. We've got some iPad news. We've got some iPhone and iOS news, and we've got some Apple TV news. We've got all kinds of stuff coming out of there. So let's get our hands dirty and get into some of that.
Sure. How do you want to start? Should we go most expensive to least expensive?
I was thinking most important first, although I cannot guarantee the order of the other stories. But the most important announcement...
Well, it's hard to say even what the most important one is.
Yeah, it is.
A lot of people are going to get new iPhones. A lot of people are going to get new Apple TVs. A lot of people are going to get new colors of Apple Watches.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing, I don't know about most important, but definitely for me the most interesting thing is the announcement of the iPad Pro, for sure.
The iPad Pro. You know what I feel like happened today was last year after their September event, Tim Cook just started going on Apple rumors websites and printing out the articles and going around to different departments and saying, how much does it cost to do this? How hard would it be to do this? Because this year we're just getting every rumor monger's wish list.
Yeah, that actually sounds pretty good. They, you know, he looked at the, he said, there's clearly a demand for this. Let's make it.
Right. So we get an iPad Pro. It's an iPad with four speakers and a 13-inch Super HD screen.
Yeah, and that's one thing I don't really like. Okay, the four speakers. I guess, you know, I usually listen to things on headphones that are on mobile devices and not through the actual speakers. But do you think anyone actually cares about the... I guess it's more about the sound volume of something like an iPad more so than it is the actual quality of the speakers, right? I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
You can't get good sound out of something that small. That's just not an option.
Right. So they actually devoted a significant portion of the case just to the speakers. There are speaker chambers in all four corners of the iPad. And four corners make sense because if you're either going to hold it upright or, you know, horizontally, you need four speakers to have stereo sound no matter how you hold it.
Yeah, and I guess that's true, but I don't know. It's just like I know that it's going to be not the best sound quality. You know, you'd do better with headphones, like, for sure. But I guess... You know, again, if that is the thing that you use to listen to music, and maybe it's the only thing that you use to listen to music, I don't know, I could kind of see some boost, at least in the volume of things.
I think Apple's goal was not to be better than headphones. It wasn't to be better than a quality stereo system. It was to be the best sound that they could get from that device in that form factor.
Yeah, that's a good point. And they wanted to be better than the last, right? So I could see that.
Quite a bit better. I don't know. I think it's probably going to sound pretty great.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about great, but I'll give it the benefit of the doubt in that it will at least be loud enough to listen to music on, you know, if you're a college student or something, and that's the only thing you have. So, Taylor, let's talk about, I think the biggest thing you can talk about with the iPad Pro is that it's just larger, right? It's a 12.9-inch display, 13, round up to 13. And it is large enough, they showed in the event today, that it was large enough that you could put two iPads side by side, vertically, and you would have about the horizontal dimensions of the iPad Pro.
Right, it's exactly... the horizontal dimensions. The width of the iPad Pro is exactly the height of the screen of the regular iPad. And the point of that is specifically to support multitasking.
Right. So all of the apps that were built with the iPad in mind will be able to have the split screen that is coming in iOS 9, right?
Right. And they'll have that on the iPad Air 2 as well. But this will be bigger.
Yeah, yeah. So the other big thing that makes this kind of a big deal is the keyboard accessory that they're going to sell with it. And this is the first time that Apple has acknowledged that, you know, keyboard somethings for the iPad is really a thing, isn't it?
I mean, Apple has sold other people's keyboards or, you know, Bluetooth keyboards.
Yeah.
To work with iPads. They've never made one themselves. They just got the on-screen keyboard. But this new keyboard is not Bluetooth. It doesn't need a battery. It doesn't need to be charged. It just connects over a proprietary magnetic connector that's built in to the iPad Pro.
Right, so that's a new connector that we haven't seen before, and it is a little reminiscent of... the old Apple dock, I forget what that connector was called, along with the Apple Watch magnetic connector. It's kind of it seems like a fuse between the two.
Yeah, a little bit. But the point of it is that you can just sort of magnetically flop the iPad in there, and it works as both a stand and a keyboard. And in the meantime, it just kind of folds up into a regular case.
Yeah, so I guess you look at this thing, and do you think they're going after the surface? Is that their goal here? I'm not sure that's necessarily true.
You know, they are definitely going after the surface. It's a little bit different of a niche than the surface, because they don't want it to be exactly the same. But I think the iPad Pro is definitely targeting the same area between a tablet and a laptop that the Surface.
Yeah, I definitely acknowledge that.
The difference is the operating system, and to a certain extent, the implementation of this keyboard, and also the stylus, which is Apple's calling the Apple Pencil.
Yeah, that's right.
Sells for $100.
Yeah, $100. Ouch.
It's a classic joke from like 10 years ago. Is, oh, Apple would make a pencil and sell it for $100.
So, but I'm really not sure, you know, okay, that's fine. I get it. Like, they are going to compete in some way. I can acknowledge that. But they're taking such a different approach, you know, in taking iOS and scaling it to a larger screen instead of taking OS X and shrinking it down slightly. Well, not even really. I mean, you can get some pretty small screens for the smallest MacBook Air. So, you know, this is bigger than the smallest MacBook Air.
It's bigger than the new MacBook, too.
Right, yeah.
Although, I had to do some math to figure this out today, but if you are watching a widescreen movie, it's still going to look bigger on the MacBook than it is on the slightly bigger iPad Pro screen because of the dimensions.
Right. So I guess it depends on what you need to do. You know, we're still in a place where if you are like an art student and you need Photoshop, or you need something seriously professional. And by the way, they brought Adobe out on stage to demo the iOS version of, well, the various iOS versions of Photoshop. They split it into kind of some apps. And, you know, it's not going to be competitive with Photoshop on the desktop, right? So if you're a professional that needs that kind of thing, then you just can't use iOS for that kind of class of work currently. You can get close, but you can't get 100% there.
Right. So that's the big difference between the Surface segment and the iPad segment. But the iPad, they're not targeting the people who need full support. They're targeting the people who are going to use either what's already available for the iPad or who are going to develop something new for it.
Yeah, so I they're definitely different, and I wonder if in talking to people if they'll be confused by the difference, you know, what you can and cannot do with each kind of device. So they definitely tried to, you know, they brought Microsoft out to show off Word and PowerPoint and all of that, and they brought Adobe out to make the case for their various productivity apps. So they're definitely trying to make some kind of case for productivity, you know, with a larger device like this. But I just don't think it'll scale up in a way that you can have, you know, there's no way I could produce this podcast in there, for example. Or I just haven't looked and don't know. That's an option too. but yeah, these like really high-end productivity tools just aren't an option there, and they will be on the Surface Pro line going forward. So depending on your needs, that may be a better choice. But I'm definitely welcoming this device, and I'm looking forward to seeing if people will buy into it or not.
Okay, but I think the podcast itself is a pretty good bellwether. I mean, I think without having researched it that closely, I think it would be a better experience making a podcast on an iPad Pro than on a Surface 3.
Well, I'm just not sure you could even, well, I'm sure people have achieved this, but I'm not sure how you would go about taking multiple audio streams from Skype and the like, or we use Hangouts now, and mixing them together and recording them. I'm sure there has to be some kind of app that does this, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And then and then you'd have to plug in a microphone. I know if you use the camera kit, you can plug in a microphone into USB, so that would be an option.
They have microphones that plug into the headphone jack. They have microphones that plug into the lightning jack without the camera kit. And the built-in microphones are, if past iPhones are any indication, you know, might not be that bad.
Yeah, they're not that bad, but we're not going to get the quality that we get on this podcast out of those built-in microphones. Or at least from my end. You use the built-in mics occasionally, and since you're over Skype, it kind of degrades you anyway, so it doesn't sound so bad.
Well, when I use the built-in mic, what we've found is that the one on my iPhone is far superior to
better.
The one on the computer.
Yeah, that's true. That is, like, the one on your iPhone far surpasses the one that is on your laptop. And I don't know if that's like a positioning thing or if it's the actual microphone, but that has absolutely been true.
I think it has to do with circuitry and interference and possibly even the components themselves, maybe just because they're newer, maybe because they're higher quality.
Yeah, so it would be an interesting experiment if we tried to produce everything on an iPad or two. So I feel like I'd want another one for my show notes.
But that's where the multitasking comes into play.
It's true.
But yeah, I think if you're going to do a podcast on an iOS device, it would be a lot easier if you had two or three iOS devices.
Yeah, that's probably true. You need an iOS device as you need monitors, I guess. You just surround yourself with them.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm really interested to see if this actually does take off. I think I've always been a fan of the 13.3-inch laptops. I feel like they're some optimal combination of size and yet productivity. And this is pretty close to that at 12.9 inches. So I feel like this class of device would enable a lot more people to completely never buy a laptop ever, and be absolutely okay with that and be productive and do what they need to do, you know, go to college and write papers and do research. I feel like just stretching the screen out just a little bit really would aid people that much more, and it would compare more favorably to a laptop than the smaller cramped iPad.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a serious contender for liberal arts college students.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wonder if I could just be wrong in that this screen size doesn't really matter and you just have to get used to a smaller screen. I don't know. We'll find out over time and see how this does. You know, iPad sales have been dwindling a little bit. I feel like they saturated the market already, and you can hold on to an iPad for quite some time. You know, it doesn't like kill itself or anything. We've talked about this before, that in modern days with computers, we're almost at a place where you can just get some arbitrary computer that's not insanely cheap, at least, and you'll get pretty good performance out of that thing, and it'll last for some years. So I feel like that's been the case a little bit with the iPad. But I wonder if the attraction of this as where its stance is more of a productivity device will kind of juice those sales up a little bit in the future.
Yeah, so my iPad is 3 years old now, and it's going strong. It's the iPad 4, and it's the main thing that is telling me I don't need to get an iPad Pro, because this one still works great.
Yeah, like, why would you, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, I wanted to mention one more thing, and we should have mentioned at the top when we were talking about this, but the screen is 2732 by 2048. That is the resolution of the screen. So that's 264 PPI.
So the other iPads are 2048 by 1536.
Right. So like we mentioned, you can put two vertical iPads in the space of a horizontal iPad Pro.
Yep. Same size, same display ratio, 3x4. And basically the same, the apps work all the same, but the stylus is meant specifically for targeted use, mainly for drawing, it seems like.
Yeah, at least that's how they were selling it. They were saying, you know, this is going to be like a Cintiq kind of thing, you know, an artist's pen that will write on the surface. And, you know, I don't know if the thing is nuanced enough to actually fulfill that task. I'd really have to get, you know, like somebody who really knows, you know, professional artistry to do that kind of thing.
They made a big point of detailing its technical capabilities in service of that task. So it's got an accelerometer in it, so it can tell when it's tilted. So it'll change the method of input by its tilt. It's got force sensors in it, so it measures pressure. And it has the ability to distinguish between fingers and stylus, so you can use one in relation to the other. Like you can use your finger to pivot a ruler or something so that you can draw a line in different directions.
Yeah, and, I know they've done some of that. The question is whether they've gotten to a level that the like professional tools from Wacom have gotten.
I think they certainly have. It's just a question of whether the software can replicate that.
Yeah, and I guess that's the question we've come back to again. Is, you know, is it going to be good for you know, somebody replacing a sketchbook? Sure, I'd totally buy that instantaneously, no question. If you want to replace a sketchbook, this seems awesome. Even for professional artists, right? If you want to replace a sketchbook, then totally makes sense. But, you know, are you going to start using this as your sole device at work? You know, I'm not so sure about that.
No, probably not. But it may replace a Wacom tablet. It may replace a laptop when you're on the go.
Yeah, we're just like, we're on the precipice of devices like this and the Surface Pro, like just pushing over that professional edge of, you know, they're like 5% away or something like that from just pushing over a precipice and being able to do literally everything that any arbitrary desktop computer setup would be able to do.
Right. So Apple wants to be there. Apple wants to force the issue.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
And Microsoft is already doing that. So.
All right. I'm going to give the last word on the iPad Pro to Die Hard in the chat room, who you may have heard of before. He says, imagine holding an iPad Pro up over your head to take a photo at a wedding, because I guarantee you that will be happening.
It's not that more ridiculous than a regular size iPad, which people do anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Don't do that. If you listen to the end user, just don't do that. Unless it's your own only camera, then maybe you have an excuse, but don't do that.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. You know, they didn't even really talk about the camera on the iPad Pro.
Yeah, it's true. They didn't give it any time, did they?
They just didn't mention it at all. I mean, I think it was in the specs. I think it just has the same as the iPad Air. It also, of course, has Touch ID. Yeah. And it has a 10-hour battery life. It is slightly thicker than the iPad Air 2. It's about as thick as the original iPad Air. And it weighs slightly more than the original iPad at 1.57 pounds.
Yeah. So, I mean, all around, this thing is nothing. You throw it in any kind of... if you're putting this in the class of productivity device that the... smaller the MacBook is and the MacBook Air is, then, you know, it's the same amount of nothing, right? These things are so tiny nowadays. It's really easy for you to carry these things around.
Definitely. But I don't know. The other iPads are still a lot more portable. This is for when you want a really big screen.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's what makes it exciting. Okay, what's our price here?
The price is $800, $799 for just the iPad with 32 gigabytes of memory.
Right. And then we have the optional keyboard cover, which is an extra $169, and we mentioned the price of the Apple Pencil, which is $100, $99.
Right. And then you can upgrade to 128 gigabytes, so there's no 64 gigabyte version. There's no 16 gigabyte version. So the jump from 32 to 128 is another $150, $949. And then on top of that, there is the traditional LTE-equipped version for an extra $139 on top of that, for a total of $1,079. Add in the keyboard cover and the stylus, you're up to $1,250.
Yeah, so all in all, you know, it's going to be a little, if you're comparing it to productivity devices like the MacBook Air and whatnot, it's going to be a little bit cheaper.
Yes, still a little cheaper than the MacBook. More expensive than the 11-inch MacBook Air.
Right. All right, well, shall we move on to the next Apple device? We're going to have a ton of them here. They really talked about a lot.
I want to go ahead and mention that the iPad Air 2 was not updated, but the iPad Mini was. So the iPad Mini, they only gave it a couple of minutes, but they said it gets all the same new chips that the iPad Pro does in the same iPad Mini form factor. So that's a pretty good deal, and that starts at $400.
Yeah, that's a pretty nice little budget option, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is 7.9 inches instead of 12.9.
Yeah, so that's
a lot smaller, but a
that's
very
what
good
we
size.
That's what we in 2015 call phone sized.
It's a really nicely sized tablet, though.
Yeah,
the iPad Mini.
Yeah,
if you don't already have a phablet.
All right, so let's move on into some Apple Watch news. They talked about it just a little bit. They didn't go crazy on the Apple Watch, but we've got some new bands, some new materials, some new colors coming on the Apple Watch. Nothing groundbreaking, but what do we got here?
Yeah, so the Apple Watch Sport is getting the two new anodized aluminum colors that Apple has added to their lineup. So now the aluminum Apple Watch Sport will come in space gray, silver, gold, and rose gold, Apple's fancy pink color.
Right.
On top of that, they have announced a couple of new bands, including a handful by Hermes in leather, some fancy third-party straps that will be available in October, along with a whole new set of colors for the sport strap, the sport band, and a product red band that comes with a special edition stainless steel Apple Watch.
Yeah, one of the bands from Hermes, which, you know, I'm not a fashion person, I have no idea, but it looked interesting. It was a leather band that wrapped twice around your wrist instead of once, and I feel like that'll really, again, I'm clueless about this, but I feel like that is a brand that will really appeal to some more fashionable people than me.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it will. I mean, on design and just on the fact that it's an Hermes strap for Apple Watch.
Yeah, exactly right. So then they also, during the event, they went on to demo a couple apps, and I figured we wouldn't talk a whole lot about that. But one of them was an app for doctors, which I just felt like did too much in that, you know, it's really just too much information to try to shove into a watch. So, you know, I'm not sure. I could be wrong, and it'll be the next biggest thing in the healthcare industry. That would be quite likely, in fact. But I feel like they're trying to cram a little bit too much into the interface in general.
Well, that's how smartwatches are going these days. It's not just Apple Watch that's trying to do that. But the medical apps that they were talking about were a couple of different apps, some of which were targeted doctors and some of which were targeted patients. And they certainly did try to squeeze a lot of demonstration into a short amount of time.
Oh, they sure did.
In practice, the watch is still only going to be doing one or two things at once. Apple showed off some new complications as well. They're excited about third-party complications.
That was the funniest phrase to me, by the way. I don't think I had stumbled across that phrase quite yet.
Oh, complications?
Yes.
Yeah, it's anything on a watch face that doesn't tell time.
Yeah, I don't remember them saying that before. It could have just passed me by.
Yeah, they made a big deal out of it.
Okay.
So most of that actually just comes from Watch OS 2, which they've now announced will be launching alongside iOS 9 on September 16th, before the new color watches and new bands and new products come out.
So that's pretty much the Apple Watch. That part was kind of short in the keynote, but they spent some time with the Apple TV, including some gaming stuff. We've got really a lot to bite into with the Apple TV. What's your overall impression of the new stuff with Apple TV? Are you buying this like immediately, imminently? Have you already bought one in the future?
I'm pretty tempted, and certainly a version of future me has already bought this. So this is the Apple TV that everyone has been waiting for since the last one came out.
Yeah,
so
this is the first major update to Apple TV, isn't it?
Well, I would say the leap from Apple TV 1 to Apple TV 2 was a pretty big update.
Yeah, that's very true. So the second one, you're right.
On par with that. So like the first Apple TV.
I don't even count that one really in my head.
Yeah,
you know?
it had a lot of storage in it. You could get it in 40 gigabytes or 120 gigabytes. And the second generation Apple TV, they said, we're not doing local storage anymore.
Screw that.
We're going to put it all in the cloud. You can just stream it. It has 8 gigabytes. That's all you need to play the stuff that you want now. So the new Apple TV comes in 64 gigabytes or 128 gigabytes, which sounds really familiar. And so I guess that's because it's designed to download more apps. So the storage isn't for content anymore. It's for apps. And they had a hard time explaining what those apps were going to be. They showed off a couple of games. They were pretty simple games.
Yeah, the games looked like a non sequitur to me. It's like, okay, great. You've got gaming capabilities from the Wii from like 8 years ago or something like that. I don't know about the gaming seemed kind of ridiculous to me. You know, the core experience of the TV experience looked interesting, and you know, somebody who is using apps to stream things over the top, I'm on board, I get it, but the games just seem like a distraction.
Right, so then they showed some shopping apps, and that was kind of interesting, but it's like, okay, you're not really doing anything a computer or an iPad couldn't do better. They said, your TV can give you such wonderful, luscious detail on these pictures of clothing. But the new iPad Pro could give you 3 times as much detail.
Yeah, I think the fashion stuff, that was with guilt. I think that's even worse. It's like, okay, now there's a website on the TV. That's really wonderful. I don't think that is in the slightest bit interesting.
Okay, yeah, but the games are not the point. The apps are not the point.
Yeah.
The apps are there because...
Well, they're kind of the point.
People have been asking for apps for Apple TV ever since there were apps for iPhone. So Apple's just saying, okay, here's an API. Now you have apps. Go make whatever you want.
Yeah. So now that is the big deal that I think a lot of people have been waiting for, is to have some real third-party app support. And, you know, not just like the built-in apps, but for developers to be able to get this and build some apps and do great things. You know, the core app experiences have always been there, right?
Yeah.
Netflix and Hulu, those have always been there, right?
Well, no, they haven't always been there.
Well, I mean, in recent times, I guess.
Yeah.
Since the last update.
That's been the point of the previous Apple TV. The point of the new Apple TV is something different. So you would think that apps would be really important, really fundamental to this new Apple TV experience. And in a way they are, but I think it's something else about the Apple TV that is the main selling point.
Okay. What's your call here?
So this is what I think Steve Jobs meant when he said that he had cracked TV. This is what he was getting at. This is what they were waiting for. The Apple TV is just software for your TV, and it's better than everybody else's software, and here's why. This is why it's better than any smart TV.
Well, yeah, and that is not too hard, by the way.
So, well, this is Apple's vision. I haven't tried it. I don't know if this is true, but this is what Steve Jobs meant. This is what Apple's going for. You interact with your TV only through Apple TV. The goal is to give you everything that you need and to do it easily in a way that is future-proof and supported and intuitive. So first thing is the remote. The remote talks to Apple TV over Bluetooth, but then it has infrared to control everything else. It turns on your TV. It controls the volume. You can teach it if you have a surround sound system, if you have a sound bar, if you have a DVD player, it can probably control that, although Apple doesn't really care about DVD players. They just want it to be able to control the TV and your sound system.
Yeah, and it does this over HDMI CEC, which I love. That's perfect. There are a lot of components out there that don't support CEC, but kind of going forward into a future vision of TV, CEC is probably the way to go.
So it has HDMI CEC, and that's crucial, but I think it is also going to be able to work as a learning remote for your components where HDMI doesn't support.
Right, where that fails.
Dual direction, yeah. So even if you have HDMI CEC, your TV might only turn on over infrared. So the new Apple remote has infrared, and you can use the Apple TV to look up the codes and teach the remote and control everything. So now you have Apple TV, and you have one remote that turns everything on, which for $150 is as good a deal as you can find on the market right now if you want that, just for that remote. That's a $150 feature.
That's fair. I mean, if it does actually work like that and they're going after Harmony or something, you know, those Harmony remotes are very expensive.
Yeah. So that's the one thing. They're going after Harmony. So now you have one remote, and that's a big deal. Now you want one interface. And Apple was really clear about this today. They say the interface is apps. Like, we don't have channels. We don't have satellite TV. Like, it's apps. You pay for the content. You get the app. Anybody can make an app. Everybody put an app. You can decide what apps you want. And that's that. So you have a remote. The remote works easily and scans through all the apps. If you have too many apps, if you have too many channels, the remote has Siri. Just ask Siri whatever you want, and it'll do it. Oh, and if you're looking for content, if you're looking for something specific, you can just search for it, and we'll tell you where to find it.
Yeah, that was the one killer. They had a page, I think it was New Girl or something, up on screen where you were viewing this kind of like meta page of description of with a description of New Girl and or whatever show they were showing. I forget exactly which one it was, but you know, you had a big full bleed photo and you had a description, and then it said this is available on these apps. You know, it was Hulu and Amazon and whatever, Netflix, and that I think is pretty powerful. Being able to have developers, I don't know, register the content that they have available to the users to Apple in a way that they can display it up front. That is very powerful and something that a lot of other devices don't have.
Well, it must be populated primarily by IMDb or something. They must have a centralized database, because they went to the Modern Family meta page and then they said, show me the one with Edward Norton in it.
Right. Nice.
So that, I think, is the main point of Apple TV. The apps that we saw today, the games that we saw, the gaming capability feature even is an afterthought. I mean, I think they'll have good support for the games, but what you need to have good Apple TV games is good developers who understand the API and are willing to do a lot of work. And you're probably going to need some third-party controllers, which they have announced will be supported by Apple TV.
Yeah, so I guess Harmony could step in here and make a controller or have the Harmony be a controller. That's a cool thought.
Oh, I wonder if we will see, like, remote controller hybrids along the spectrum of TV control and video game control trying to replace the Apple remote.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
Like, awesome little ecosystem bonus here for the Apple TV remote. It charges through a lightning cable.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Everything's going to be a lightning cable from here on out with Apple, right?
Sure, yeah. I mean, but the old remote was watch battery powered, so this is a nice upgrade, and you probably have a lightning cable plugged in near your TV somewhere.
So, Taylor, here's the one thing that will kill this entire model, and that's if they don't give up their 30% grasp that they have in the App Store. I'm not sure they even mentioned that deal for developers, or maybe they did somewhere else, but I don't remember them mentioning that. Did they talk about that?
No, but I don't think they'll give it up either.
Yeah. So if they're going to give up, or if they're not going to give up their 30% grasp onto the third-party content like from Amazon, Amazon is just not going to put the content up there in a way that makes it easy for users to get at. So I'm not sure how all that is going to pan out, but that's definitely some kind of hurdle in the way.
Well, yeah, they're not going to get Amazon. They're not really planning to.
Yeah, so in that case, I don't know, like nearly everything except for Orphan Black is available elsewhere that I've been watching recently. So, I don't know amount of content that's on Amazon compared to say Netflix. There's not a lot there that isn't available on Netflix. So, again, with the exclusion of Orphan Black, maybe it's not that important.
Well, there is a workaround. You can subscribe or buy to Amazon from a computer.
Right.
You can log into Amazon Video on iPhone or an iPad.
And you get a library.
And then you can stream it. Or if you have a newer model Mac, you can AirPlay it. So Amazon may, in fact, create an app with their library. It's just that you'll have to go outside of Apple to buy it.
To actually spend money, right.
Yeah, but you'll still be able to watch everything on Amazon Prime. So Amazon might do that. That's the thing. Apple's washing their hands of it. They say, here's an app store. Make whatever you want. Oh, Amazon's not going to make an app. I guess they're too good for us.
Yeah. Well, but I don't know. I feel like there are enough people out in the world that have Amazon Prime that there should be some pressure on them to be able to include that kind of thing. It would be a win for their users, but it's definitely not a business win for Amazon to give up 30% of their sales.
No, of course not.
Yeah.
And that's why they don't let you buy anything.
Yeah. And here we find ourselves, Taylor. Here we find ourselves.
Okay, so that's always going to be a problem, but I think Apple may have negotiated with enough companies or just set the terms strict enough that any app developer may have to submit their content to Universal Search.
Right.
And maybe Amazon wants to put their content on there.
Well, and they can at least put all of their content that's available to everyone for free in there, at very least, right?
Well, Amazon doesn't have any content that's available to everyone for free.
Or I mean, available to anyone who logs in for free. Like anyone who has Prime and is able to log in.
Right.
They could.
So it's to Amazon's advantage if they can get you to their app and then click on a shortcut or something that will get you to their store on your computer and then go back to the app and watch it. So it's to their advantage to include Universal Search in their app.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about the things that Apple TV doesn't have. First of all, it doesn't yet have Amazon Prime. No one knows if it will. We're just speculating.
We don't know.
Second of all, it does not have optical audio output anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
So they removed it. Now the only way you can get audio or video off of the Apple TV is HDMI. So it's just got Ethernet, power, HDMI, and a diagnostic port.
Yeah, so that's one of those things that makes life simpler if you fit the bill, you know. But, you know, some people need that. I remember I was in a situation some time ago where, for whatever reason, the surround sound out of HDMI didn't work for my particular setup, so I had to use the optical audio, and that worked. So it's nice to have those options.
Right. So
but I guess it's not a receiver either, is it?
I still need that because I have a projector, and so my audio is completely separate from my video. Now, Apple upgraded the Bluetooth in this thing. If they happen to have replaced optical audio with high-definition Bluetooth audio support, then that might solve my problem. But AirPlay is not going to cut it for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. But so other than those little detail, I think we've seen a hugely positive forward-looking improvement to the Apple TV. I don't know about, you know, TV of the future, but this is definitely a gigantic improvement for that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that Apple really wants to do a lot more with this. And they want developers to do a lot more with this. And so they had to get it out there. Frankly, they just waited too long for this.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. All right, well, let's get into the last of the Apple announcement here. And let's talk a little bit about the improvements to the iPhone. We've got a TikTok cycle, as we know. You've got the iPhone X and then the XS, right? So we are now on the iPhone 6S and the 6S Plus. So what is in that cacophony of sibilance, what are the improvements here for the new iPhones? Are you excited? Are you jumping ship?
I'm a little jealous. I'm a little more jealous than I thought I was because I have the previous generation. I'm not going to upgrade. I'm okay with it. I definitely do not need a rose gold iPhone. That's the new color. They've added it to this line as well. So now iPhones and Apple Watches come in four colors. iPads come in three colors. MacBooks come in three colors. The Apple TV still comes in one.
But they seem to make a big deal out of the rose gold. I feel like that's the one that people are most excited about.
It's just the new one. I don't think are excited about
that's it.
Some people will be. A certain subset of people will be very excited about it. But they just like showing off the new stuff.
Yeah, that's just the one
that's
that,
why people get excited about it.
That's how you know somebody has a 6S, right, is if it's rose gold.
Exactly. So the other new feature that's a little bit harder to notice is a new iteration of Force Touch that they're now calling 3D Touch. And the reason they've renamed it is because, not because they've really changed the technology from Force Touch, but they changed the implementation. So there is a three-level touch feedback system that works by how hard you press it and how long you press it that will basically preview something as you hold it and then open it up for you if you keep holding it. And they're calling that pop and snap.
So this is one thing that really struck me in the keynote as just being really un-Apple. It really complicates things when you add this layer of interface onto things. But one thing that struck me a little bit is as long as people don't abuse it and it's not a part of the standard paradigm of interaction, then I feel like it's okay. You know, if the intermediate and long touches are somewhere that really doesn't matter, you know, like it's a nice icing on the cake kind of feature, then okay, that's fine, because basically if you didn't know about it, you could never use it and you would miss absolutely nothing. And it looks to me with the way they've implemented their apps, then that is exactly how it works. What I'm a little afraid of is if that API is open to developers, they're going to start doing some interesting things with that that would be completely hidden to the user. And it just, I feel like if people start to abuse things and menus may be hidden under three layers of touch, then, you know, maybe that's not the best user experience. So I feel like it's really up to the developers, and I feel like Apple, from what I saw, did a pretty decent job of it. But, you know, Apple is famous for just not allowing people to do that in the first place. And by kind of limiting the user experience in such a way, then their platform is traditionally easier to use, right?
Yeah, I think this is still going to be probably pretty limited by the API or by the style guide. But I think it's going to be a lot more intuitive and well integrated than it seems like from the demonstration. It's one of those things that maybe becomes second nature by doing it more easily than by describing it. Really, I think this is, you know, this is the iteration of the right click. This is right click for touch.
Exactly.
The best way that Apple can see it right now.
And by the way, that's how Windows Phone has always had it. They've always had a tap and a long click. Of course, this is pressure based, so I'm not sure how that'll all fit together. But it was fine on Windows Phone. I can tell you, it was okay. Like, I knew that it was part of the user interface to try that sometimes, and sometimes I tried it. You know.
Yeah. So Apple already had the long click for rearranging icons, and so they had to come up with something
good point. So I don't know. We'll see how that goes over. You know, like I said, I feel like if this is a flop and nobody ever uses it, then it's okay because it's kind of out of the way unless some developers abuse it. So either way, it's kind of okay. It's a ringing endorsement, I realize.
I think it'll probably be locked out more to the point of frustration for the developer than for the user.
Yeah, I hope that's true. So I guess we'll find out, you know, it'll take some time for that kind of stuff to float down to apps that we actually use. So we'll see.
So some other internal upgrades that they've added, they replaced the vibration motor with a version of their MacBook Taptic engine, the one that replicates a click on the MacBook. And that's an obvious upgrade. You know, Apple basically reinvented the vibrating feedback mechanism. Why not include one in the, you know, the iPhone, the one where you're going to have the most iterances and variations of vibrating feedback?
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense.
They've added a new processor, obviously. The A9 processor has M9 built onto the same die, and improvements of 70 to 90% in CPU performance and graphics performance compared to the A8. And the camera has been upgraded in megapixel count for the first time since 2010. So Apple was wary about upgrading from 8 megapixels because they were afraid of degrading the image quality through crosstalk and image fade, through pixels being too close together. They reworked their image sensor to make it so that light was less likely to cross from one pixel to another, and so they felt comfortable making a bigger sensor with more megapixels.
Yeah, so that's really a hugely welcomed addition to the new iPhone, is to have the camera be slightly denser in megapixels. That I feel like will, you know, on a stat sheet, will definitely sell some phones, if nothing else.
Well, the big upgrade there, my takeaway is that it can now do 4K video recording.
Yeah, nice.
At 60 frames per second. They're also launching a sort of proprietary picture feature. When you take a picture with the iPhone camera, it'll record a little bit before and a little bit after that. So every picture becomes a little 1-second video. So, Chris, we had the Vine 6-second videos, and now it's like half a second. That's videos now.
Yeah,
except they're just photos.
I'm going to start a Twitter clone only for 1-second videos from iPhones called GIF Express. It's going to be huge. Wait for it.
That's actually pretty smart. There should be a photo sharing service that's just for iPhone moments or whatever they call it, Picture Plus.
Yeah, exclusive. All right. Well, I'll have that in a week, Taylor.
Nice. You'll be the new iPhone to market.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Good point. I guess I would need to test it, wouldn't I?
Okay. So Apple has also upgraded the LTE to 23 bands and 300 megabits per second. Wi-Fi 802.11ac now goes up to 866 megabits per second if you have the router that can support that. You can get it for the regular prices of $199 for the base model iPhone 6 to $499 for the highest end iPhone 6S Plus. They are also detailing a lot of other payment options because so many carriers are doing alternative payment methods, and Apple's joining the fray on that. They are offering an iPhone upgrade program at Apple stores where if you pay $32 a month or more, depending on the model, you get Apple Care for the phone included, and you get an automatic upgrade as long as you keep paying the fee.
Yeah, that's really cool. That could be a cash cow.
It certainly will be, and it may be worth it for the money, but I haven't done the calculation, and that's on top of what you're paying your carrier.
Yeah, but still, for a lot of people, phones have this like temporary existence, and you know, to just subscribe to it, given how often you upgrade, it might make sense. I don't know. Maybe it's ridiculous, and we just haven't done the math.
Maybe it is. I'm sure someone will soon enough. We'll let you know when they do. You have until September 25th before the iPhones are launched. I haven't seen anything about pre-orders this year. But I have one other note, and it's for any users of current iPhones and iPads. The iCloud storage plan pricing is changing again. It used to be an annual fee for some paltry amount of storage. Then they upgraded to 5 gigabytes for free, and they still have the same free amount, but now instead of 20 gigabytes for $1 a month, you get 50. 200 gigabytes is now $3 a month instead of $4, and you can go up to a terabyte for $10 a month, which is cheaper than it used to be as well. So they've revised the storage plans for a little bit more storage. This will save some people some money because if you had more than 20 gigabytes on your iCloud, including your email, you used to have to go up to 200 gigabytes. Now you can go to 50 for $1 a month. So I'm actually going to save $3 a month once these new plans hit.
Yeah, so we also know that this is going to launch with iOS 9, yes?
Yes, iOS 9 will be launching a week before this phone.
And we've talked about this previously, so we won't get into the details of iOS 9. But we do now know exactly when people who aren't upgrading will get it. And when is that? Are you looking forward to that?
September 16th, and that's when people will get Apple Watch updates as well. So I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah,
I've
so
been
just
beta
a week
testing
from now.
On my iPad, and I'm certainly looking forward to my iPhone having some of those features as well. It's a nice upgrade, although the beta is a little buggy, which is to be expected.
Yeah, that's just how it goes.
Yeah. And the Apple TV launches in late October.
Oh, good point.
And the iPad Pro will be available sometime in November.
Yeah, good point. That's probably a pretty good end cap on the news coming out of the Apple event, don't you think? Did you have any last kind of general impressions from the event? It was really frenetic.
What, you don't want to hear my in-depth review of the One Direction concert?
I really have no desire.
I didn't stick around to listen to it.
I didn't either.
By that point, the event had been going on for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I did not want to follow it anymore. And I did not want to hear One Direction at that particular juncture.
Yeah. Well, that can be stressful for a person.
Maybe a little.
All All right. Well, did you have any impressions as a whole, you know, how the presentation went as a kind of wrap up of the Apple event?
Once again, I think Tim Cook printed out a bunch of websites or articles from Mac or yeah. Apple Rumors
yeah.
websites and went around saying, how much this costs, how much will this cost to build and how much will it make us? And then the ones they thought were a good idea, that's what came out today.
Yeah. So so a lot of people are very happy right now is probably the upshot of that, isn't it?
Yeah, but for me personally, I find myself still waiting. There's nothing that I want to get right now, although I definitely will be checking them out and checking for certain features, and I might change my mind. But right now, nope, I'm waiting for another MacBook.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. I mean, this is the talk, not the tick. So I feel like you're more likely to get in on the tick since you like the newer features and redesigns and stuff. So that
well, I've
sense.
Been I've always been on the tick cycle for the iPhone, but for everything else, you know, it's been a big tick year, and I don't know. It seems like there's always another tick after the talk.
So it's talk. It's tick, talk, tick, and then two ticks. Is that how it goes?
Two ticks and a talk. Sure.
Right, there you go. All right. Well, I think that will do it for our Apple top news from the Apple event. That was like I said, it was a very frenetic event. They talked about a whole ton of things and talked about it at length. So, a lot of stuff to talk about there. So,
yeah, including it really can't be understated. Representatives from Adobe and Microsoft.
That's right. Yeah.
When they've they're directly challenging Microsoft with the product they had Microsoft demonstrate, and they've practically been at war with Adobe in recent years over Flash.
Yeah, but both of those companies have now come around to Apple's platform, so I feel like now's the time to let them in, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it shows a great partnership. You know, it's almost like having Samsung up on stage with them. That'll never happen.
Oh, you just wait. Samsung's going to release a iPencil or a Apple Pencil replacement. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Well, Samsung has plenty of stylus experience.
Yeah, it's going to be for the Apple Watch. That's where it gets unique.
Do not want.
Yeah. Although if anybody did it, it would definitely be Samsung, wouldn't it? All right. Well, let's wrap up our Apple event news. But like I said, crazy event. Lots to talk about. We'll have some, I'm sure we'll have some more of the details flowing out over the next couple weeks as, you know, people get their hands on and that kind of thing, and reviews come out eventually. So we'll be back here for a couple weeks to come, I bet. I wanted to talk about one last top news story. This is one of the ones that we kind of missed because we've missed a few weeks' worth of shows here in our rather casual summer schedule, and that is that Google has released some router, and they're calling it the OnHub. It's actually built by TP-Link, and it's basically built to be the simplest router you've ever used, and, you know, it's got one Ethernet port on the back. It's not really designed to be a full-fledged, you know, router with a ton of Ethernet ports. But, you know, you give it some internet and they'll give you a port and they'll give you a bunch of Wi-Fi since you're expecting that most people are using Wi-Fi anyway. There's a USB plug on the back as well, but it's currently inactive, so they're not doing anything with that. Now, where it gets a little more interesting, perhaps, is with the Bluetooth and Zigbee radios that are built into the router but not enabled. So maybe this is some kind of harbinger for their future Internet of Things or home automation play that we're just seeing for the moment. That is a very interesting prospect.
Yeah, I like this. It looks great. It looks easy to use, powerful enough. I don't know who's the target market here.
Yeah, you know, I'm not. I had the same feeling too. Oh, and it looks like a trash can, like the Mac Pro does, right? It's this big, or maybe like a Amazon Echo or something. It's this big tube-looking thing. It's something you wouldn't mind putting on display. It's kind of pretty. So, but
yeah, call me when I can get a router. Call me when I can get a modem that I can put on display.
Yeah, good point.
Those things are always going to be ugly.
Good point. So, but the way you set it up is there's an Android app that you can use to actually set this device up, and that looks really, really friendly. And there are some features missing, but, you know, I feel like this is kind of a experimental first play into the router market. You know, there are probably some concerns about privacy with Google and them making your router. I could see that argument coming in too, but you know, I give them the benefit of the doubt. I doubt they're doing anything nefarious from the router level. But the user experience of setting this up is almost assuredly going to be better than your typical router. That's going to be the selling point. And if that selling point is worth $200 to people, then I guess that's fine. But, you know, people are used to getting really cheap routers, setting it somewhere and letting it collect dust and not worrying about it ever again until the internet goes down and you have to reboot it, obviously. But I think the aim of this router is not to do that. And there are other $200 routers out on the market. So, you know, it's not completely out of left field to have a quality, well-designed router be $200. And I think the user experience of setting this thing up could be kind of compelling.
Yeah, Apple has been selling a well-designed quality router for $200 for like a decade now.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Well, and there were other ones. There are other ones from other companies as well. But they're definitely not as well-designed as the AirPort.
Right, and AirPort always had an app that helped you set it up, and it always had, you know, a light that was easy to read that told you whether it was working. But no, those only worked for Apple users. So now any Android user has the same experience, which is great.
Yeah, and then interestingly, not for Apple users, right? So it's only people with an Android phone that can really get the benefit of using that app.
Well, clearly they rushed this one to market a bit. They're still working on some features.
Oh, yeah.
That are in the hardware but not enabled.
Yeah, I think that Zigbee radio in there, that's where it gets interesting. You know, okay, they released a router, it's a router, and it works well, and it's well-designed. Okay, I believe it. I'm not that excited about it, but I believe it. But they have home automation radios in it. Okay, now I'm listening, because that could be a big thing going down the line.
It certainly could be. So would we recommend holding off on this product for now?
Well, I don't know. It depends on who you are. It could be interesting.
The target market, there's nobody. It doesn't make any sense. But so much potential in the Google On Hub.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if you're a you know, Google enthusiast kind of person and you want a really nice router, then this would make a lot of sense. But there are some other routers out there. You know, I have the Nighthawk. Its user experience isn't very good, but it works and it gets the job done. And it's got enough features, and you know, I've really enjoyed it so far.
I have a small army of Apple wireless devices. No one's surprised.
Okay, Taylor. Well, should we get out of the top news? I really just wanted to mention that. It happened some time ago, so I wasn't sure if we should cover it or not, but I'm glad we did. But
yeah, I'm glad too. It's a neat little thing, and it speaks to future ventures that can be very interesting.
So here, let me pour you a little bit more champagne, and then
yes.
Yes.
Thank
there
you.
There you are, sir. And then you can get started with the afterburners for us, if you're strapped
okay.
in already.
Pandora is doing a 24-hour internet radio pass that's... it gets rid of ads on Pandora for $1 for a day.
Yeah, so that seems like actually a pretty steep price for a streaming music service if you pay for it every day for a month.
Yeah, only if you add it all up. But people are going for those. You know, Pandora's grabbing those people who they're not going to get the monthly fees. And they just figure they'll collect a dollar here, a dollar there, and it all adds up.
So Motorola has released a new version of the Moto 360. They've redesigned the bands and the way the chassis looks a little bit. And they're actually, it's actually three different watches. There's a men's version in two sizes and a single women's version. And from what I can see, they look like a pretty nice little update. Now, they're also going to be at the just-released price of $299 to start and $430 for the premium one. But it looks like a pretty neat little update to the Moto 360, because the Moto 360 has gotten a little old at this point, so it's good to see them give it a little refresh. And I think they've done a pretty good job of keeping the essence of what made the Moto 360 good, and also providing a little bit of a new style injection to it.
Yeah, these look great. In fact, they look so good that Samsung's new smartwatches copy this instead of other Square smartwatches. The Samsung Galaxy Gear 2 now has a round face, and the collar around the face is the adjustment mechanism, you know, is the smart crown for their devices. But it's still not an Android watch. It's a Samsung Tizen OS watch.
Yeah, Tizen. That one stands alone and has a SIM, you know, and has a virtual SIM in it, actually. So that's kind of bizarre, but it's definitely, there is some market out there for it. I know that for a fact.
Cool. So here is something that there's definitely a market for, is Hulu's new commercial-free option.
Yeah, here we go.
Hulu was always free to watch online. You could pay for Hulu Plus, which is now just called Hulu, but it's the paid version, for $7.99, which would give you access to additional content and additional platforms to watch it on, but you still had to watch all of the same ads. So now for $12 instead of $8, you can have the paid version of Hulu without the ads.
Yeah, definitely a good option to see from them. So slightly big but not big news for Google. They've redesigned their logo slightly, and they've pretty much shaved off the serifs on the font and called it a day. But it looks way more modern this way. A lot of people were really upset. I guess people are easily upset, but it seems like a decent improvement to me, and ultimately, it doesn't really matter what their logo looks like, honestly. But they did update their logo. If you have not noticed yet, then we have a link to a Fast Company article talking about the design of this thing at some pretty great length. So maybe if you're into design, that could be a pretty cool, or you know, typefaces and that kind of thing, that could be a pretty good read for you. So we've got that in the show notes.
It is certainly jarring to me, but I'm sure I'll get used to it. It's just Google hasn't updated their logo
forever,
in 16 years.
Yeah.
Except they sort of update it every day, but then they sort of don't.
Right. Well, and it does look more modern. At that is the very least you could say of it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right, so that will do it for our quick afterburners, and we'll get into the end user stories. And we're not too far from the end of the show at this point. We've only got a couple of these end-user stories. Taylor, I wanted to mention here in this segment that I actually went out and purchased a new TV. So that's always a pretty big technology purchase for the household.
Yes, this was a big purchase. I had a chance to look at your new TV over the weekend.
Yeah, so I got an iPad Pro, and I'm just propping it. I'm just propping it up on a desk. That's what I'm doing.
You just nailed it to the wall.
Yeah, I hung it from the wall. That's the new TV. No,
yeah,
so
you don't
obviously
have to worry about battery.
I didn't
It'll
get a pre-release.
10 hours. He'll be dead by then.
So obviously that I didn't get a pre-release iPad Pro. So anyway, I got the what is considered a budget 4K TV. This is the Vizio M60 C3, and I actually got it off of Woot. I wonder how many people get TVs off of Woot, but the return policy is fairly brutal, but you get a pretty decent upfront price. So basically, after 90 days, if something happens, then I'm screwed. But the price was cheap enough, and I was thinking about, I've been thinking about for some time upgrading the TV recently, and I felt like that culmination of events led to me getting this. From a perspective of upgrading from my old TV, this thing, you know, regardless of its size, which is much different than the last TV, is just substantially better looking in all manners of using it. I'm very impressed coming from a fairly old 1080p TV. And I should say also that while this is a 4K TV, there's basically no 4K content out there. And also my receiver doesn't support 4K. So all of that 4K-ness is kind of out the window, but I'd like to get there at some point in time. Maybe I'll need to upgrade my receiver eventually, but I don't feel a pressing need to go about doing that quite yet.
Is there like any way at all to like even see a picture in full definition?
I could probably, I don't know how the, if my home theater PC would support that resolution or do well with it. That has yet to be seen. But potentially we could get a 4K image and, or even a video and plug it directly into the TV. I'm not sure if that would work with my graphics card or not.
You should give it a shot. You should find out.
I should. It wouldn't be that hard to just unplug the thing from the receiver and plug it directly into the TV. So I did read up a little bit about the graphics card that I have, and apparently it supports 4K content. What I'm not sure of is if it supports it over HDMI or, you know, there's all kinds of issues flying around. So I'm actually not quite sure if it will or not. So I guess we'll find out. You're right. I should try that.
Well, you got to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's pretty cool. And it is a lovely looking TV, even when it's not displaying 4K content.
Right. So actually you were over here and we were watching some Planet Earth, and at least for our viewing space, it's fairly large. It's 60 inches, and in a relatively small apartment, that's a pretty big TV for the space. So I think it's appropriate for the space, and I think it, again, it's hard for me to judge because it's so above and beyond the old TV that I was used to. That of course it looks fantastic. You know, any modern TV would look fantastic. Just about. Coming from an older model, but this thing had fairly good reviews, and you know, I tuned the colors on it, and I've been fairly happy with it so far.
Yeah, you should be. Looks good. Good value. I approve.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a pretty good. As long as it doesn't break, as long as it doesn't break on like the 93rd day after, you know, after the warranty is entirely expired, and there's nothing you can do about it, then. I think it was a pretty good move, but
it's only $10 a day.
Yeah, right. So that'll be, you know, I don't mind like cracking it open and replacing a capacitor or something like that. Yeah, obviously I'd be upset, but there are ways to fix these things often, and I wouldn't mind pursuing that if I needed to. So I figure that. That kind of strict return policy applies a little bit less to me, but you can absolutely just have it get bricked too.
Yes, it's certainly possible. I've seen it.
Yeah. So anyway, I've been fairly pleased with that. That's been a pretty good addition to the household. Now I got to figure out what to do with the old TV.
Office space.
I was thinking bathroom TV. That would be good. No, not really. I'm not sure what we're going to do with it, so I don't know.
But then where's the iPod Pro going to go?
Right, good point. Good point. Well, I was thinking, you know, we'd at least keep it for the period of the warranty of the new TV, which is 90 days, so we'll see how that goes, and then I'll be figuring out what to do with it. So yeah, I think you're right. I have to plug some 4K content into it and see what's going on with that. All right, well
you'll have to let me know what happens.
Yeah, next time you're over here, we should plug some 4K content into it, if that works. We'll see. All right, well, let's move on to the end user stories. I wanted to mention this as well. With a fairly small amount of fanfare, Samsung has released its new SmartThings smart home hub. And, you know, I have SmartThings here, and that's what I use for the small amount of home automation in my apartment that I do. So it's available now in the U.S. We've got September 10th, which is tomorrow by the time this podcast airs, in the U.K. And it's going to cost $99. And, you know, it's got a bunch of little features that kind of add up. But the biggest one is that it can do some of the things that it does without an internet connection. And that is huge because I know a lot of times it happens fairly infrequently, but every once in a while, SmartThings has some kind of outage. And the consequence of that is that you have to go over to the manually switching on the lights. There's usually at least some kind of manual backup. Although I've got a couple Cree light bulbs that don't have a manual backup, but all of the outlet switches that I've got have a little button on it where you can turn the light on and off without any other kind of interaction. But that's a huge inconvenience when that does happen. And in fact, they have a very good status page that is always up to date, and they're very sensitive to those kinds of outages. But it does happen from time to time. So having a lot of these tasks work entirely locally means they're A, going to be faster, and B, they're going to happen if the internet goes down. So that kind of robustness is exactly the kind of thing you're looking for in a home automation system. And that's something that they're, you know, again, without having used it, that's something that they have in this product. So that's definitely a good thing to see from them.
Yeah, it was, it seemed to be a trend at this year's IFA conference. Especially among Internet of Things system supporters, is that they were trying to make the hub more autonomous, more localized.
And more resilient, too.
Yeah.
Right, as a consequence of its autonomy.
So,
yeah, so that's
certainly a good thing.
That's good to see. And then just to kind of pile on the heap there, that, you know, it's got a new battery backup system inside of it that'll last for about 10 hours, they're saying. So I'd imagine it's a little less than that. It usually is a little bit less than what they say. But that is also nice to see. So if the power goes out, well, if somehow the power to the device goes out, I should say, then you can still use your system. You know, obviously, if the power goes out, you're not going to have much luck turning the lights on. But if the power goes out, this thing will stay on and functioning for 10 hours. Depending on whatever you have set up, you know, that stuff may not work, but it's at least going to stay on in that case. So that's kind of a nice little thing to see. You know, or, you know, if somebody like unplugs it accidentally and then leaves it there, you know, it'll stay on. Stuff like that. You know, it's just a little extra bit of resiliency that you can build into this thing.
Yeah, that's very cool and crucial.
And then finally, they pretty much overhauled, and as far as I can tell, they rewrote the app from scratch. I don't know if that's true or not, but the app is a huge update from the old app, and they've added a handful of features to it. You know, it's more of the same. It's what you'd expect. It's not unfamiliar, but even though it's redesigned, they added a kind of neat feature where you can categorize the things you've got attached to it to various rooms, and that's kind of nice. But it seems like a pretty nice update so far, and it also hasn't gotten in the way as an update, so that's also very important. And they've added a few monitoring capabilities, so that's nice to see as well. So I don't want to labor on about it, but it seems like they've got a pretty good platform upgrade to both their app and their hardware there, and I'll be looking forward to seeing how that works out.
All right, cool. Well, Google has another project that is also aiming to make us more autonomous and resilient, but it's not a product that they're selling. It's something they're giving away for free. It's called Project Sunroof, and it uses Google Maps and their various metadata to show on Google Maps which structures will have the best opportunities for sunlight for placing solar panels. So it combines satellite data and elevation data and the Google Street View and the way that it determines the sizes and heights of buildings to figure out where which roofs in any given area are going to provide the most sunlight and the best return for solar panels. So all this is free, although it's only working in a handful of areas right now, but they're working on expanding it. And you can run some easy little calculations with sliders on the website to figure out how much power and money you can save and how much solar you'd need to install in order to maximize those savings. So it's a neat little thing. You should check it out and then find out that it's not working where you are. And then you should check back when it does.
Yeah, it doesn't work where I'm at. So that seems par for the course. But that's really cool. That if they can get that a little further out into different neighborhoods and everything, that is a really cool feature to have. You know, kind of this back of the napkin calculation on whether it even makes sense to investigate solar panels. Because, you know, for some people it doesn't.
Yeah, and for some people it requires a surveyor, and it requires like
some effort,
quotes that are not free.
to
determine how much sunlight you are capable of producing, or you know how much electricity you are from the sunlight you have, and where the solar panels are supposed to go. Google will now give you an estimate so that you can at least start making plans without spending money.
Yeah, that seems like a better first step than getting a surveyor, that's for sure. All right, Taylor, let's round out our 200th episode with our kicker this week. We've got some Star Wars news. What's happening here?
Well, this past Friday was Force Friday, which is a pretty extravagant name to give to the day they started selling some toys from the next Star Wars movie.
Nice.
But if you have seen any commercials or videos or reviews of the Sphero BB-8, you know that they have released the coolest Star Wars toy ever.
Yeah, it is a pretty cool little looking thing. It's pretty great. So everybody seems to be looking forward to the new Star Wars movie in a way that I don't remember with the prequels.
I think people were... Your memory is just clouded by what came after.
Clouded by terribleness. That's quite possible.
Yeah. So the BB-8 droid is one of the stars of the new movie. It's a sort of an R2-D2 head that's mounted on a rolling ball, and it somehow stays upright. And when the first trailer came out, everyone assumed that it was a product of computer-generated imagery. And then everyone was proven wrong when they came out with an $80 toy that is a sphere with a fake droid's head on it that you can remote control.
Right, and I guess
the head just stays on the top of it.
It's got some kind of magnetism going on to keep it up there.
Yeah, it just balances.
Yeah, that's really neat. We've got a couple, there's, you know, images and videos in our link that we have in the show notes over to Gizmodo.
Yeah, so definitely look at the videos. This is going to be the Tickle Me Elmo of this Christmas.
Nice. Yeah, well, I'd believe that, yeah.
This is, people aren't going to want Apple TVs or iPad Pros. No, some people will. But
just the BB-8.
Everybody's going to want the Sphero BB-8.
Well, let's put a Apple TV on a BB-8, and then we've got something going.
That'd be a very strange gift.
Yeah, there's an Ethernet cable hanging out the back with HDMI and stuff, you know, like all kinds of... okay, maybe not the best idea. But I definitely like to put this little guy to task and have him patrol the apartment looking for stray cats or something like that.
BB-8 versus Roomba.
Ooh, BB-8 versus Roomba versus cat.
Versus cat.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Or can it... It could probably ride the Roomba, right?
Could it ride a cat riding a Roomba?
I don't know. This is getting... We'll test this.
Okay, good.
I have all of these things except for the BB-8, so maybe we can test this. All right. Well, I think that'll do it for episode 200, and we're definitely running long, although we knew we would because we had so much to talk about, and the Apple event and the festivities around episode 200, but I think it's been a good one, Taylor.
Oh, it's been great. I've been having a great time. This episode and the 196 before it that I was on.
Yes, yeah. So I think you were on all of the previous episodes, weren't you? I missed a couple here and there.
Well, I missed the first two.
I think I missed one where I believe Josh filled in. And
mm-hmm. I think I missed one or two in the middle there as well.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I think I did one with Richard without you at some point.
Yeah, we both occasionally were sick or something in the 5 years we've been doing this. It happens.
Yeah, that makes sense. So anyway, it's been a good time, and I believe it's time to sign off and perhaps drink some more champagne. So, Taylor, if somebody wanted to send you some champagne or Prosecco over the internet in some way, how would they go about doing this?
Get a Sphero BB-8, record a message in it with the app, then fill the sphere with champagne, and then drive it over to me with champagne and message. And I will decrypt the message using my Sphero BB-8 app.
And then make sure you don't spill it all over. You don't want that. That would be
That'd be hilarious.
Yeah, it would be funny. Okay. And if I recorded that, I would upload it to YouTube. That would be good. But
right,
it would be very unfortunate for you.
No, not that anyone ever would. But don't send me champagne. That's strange. That's strange and not easily mailable.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of weird.
Hang on to it.
You'd have to refrigerate it.
For a special occasion. Yeah, you earned it.
You'd have to refrigerate it. It would be a little strange.
Right. But if you are going to send me champagne, which again, don't. But if you are, then put it in a Sphero. For sure. Roll it on over.
And I don't know how you're going to get me champagne, but I am at Chris.
You've already got champagne, Chris. Nobody send him anymore.
That's true. I don't need any more champagne. But anyway, if you wanted to contact me in some way on the internet, I am at Chris Hale Barnes on Twitter. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me. So hopefully we'll see you out there on Twitter.
And I am at TaylorPhone on Twitter. But again, I'm going to endorse the BB-8 method of communication.
Better. No, that's way better.
Yeah.
All right. So Taylor, next week, we are going to have a special guest over to talk to us about TVs. We'll probably talk about that TV we talked about earlier and also talk about receivers and, you know, what that means to the end user. And he's an expert in these things. He's from the AV Rant podcast. That's at avrant.com. And he's on Twitter at First Reflect. So that is Rob H. So you'll definitely want to tune in next week. He's always very energetic and very easy to talk to. So we should have a good time for next week.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah, so looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too. Okay.
So, and lastly, I wanted to thank the Digital Media Zone for having us on their network. They got us kind of early. I forget what episode number they brought us on to the network. But just before we get out of here, that's something I wanted to mention as well.
Yes. Thank you to Josh and Richard for reaching out to us and for everybody else involved in the Digital Media Zone.
Yeah, they've been quite good hosts for us. So, all right, Taylor, it is time to get out of here. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts you can have a listen to, Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got our email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. We are @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room when we record the show live every Wednesday night, although we've been a little bit casual about that in the summertime. Regardless of when we podcast, it's usually around 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.